Welcome to the Actionable Futurist podcast, a show all about the near-term future with practical and actionable advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and actionable futurist Andrew Grill.
My guest today is Steve Cadogan, who has been at the forefront of global talent strategy and company culture for the last 30 years. He's most famous for scaling LinkedIn from 400 to 4,000 in just 3.5 years. Steve also led the development of LinkedIn's legendary company culture and was at the helm of the talent function for its period of highest growth and through their IPO. He's worked in 5 different industries and 3 different countries, and his focus today is to help leaders and organizations build winning talent solutions to compete in an increasingly complex digital economy. He's just released his new book, WorkQuake, Embracing the Aftershocks of COVID-19 to Create a Better Model of Working. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me today, Andrew. Excited.
We had a pre-interview a week or so ago, and I'm so excited to have you on the show because I agree with 200% of what you say, but it's rare that I get someone on that's been so heavily involved in LinkedIn, which is a network that many of my listeners will be using every day. Many people know that you were LinkedIn's first chief HR officer, but what drew you to LinkedIn in the first place? And do you remember when you actually joined the platform?
As a human resource executive, it made a lot of sense to me when someone showed me, hey, there's this new tool. And I'd been using a similar tool called Plaxo. I don't know if you remember Plaxo. It was contact management. And when you would move from one company to another, it would allow you to not have to rebuild your address book, usually using some kind of Outlook tool or some kind of mail client. So I liked that. And I was at a point in my career where I was starting to meet more people. My network was growing. So it made sense as it was designed. And I didn't join with any aspirations of, hey, this is going to help my career prospects. It was more just helping keep my contacts together.
I remember Plaxo well, and that was an age-old problem that, you know, who owns the contacts? And I think even a few years ago, people were saying, well, no, I own your LinkedIn contacts or your Twitter contacts, and that's just not the case, and we might get onto that. One final question on LinkedIn. People talk about gaming the LinkedIn algorithm. I'd argue that as a B2B platform, the way to get the best out of it is very different to other platforms. But what's your advice for people wanting to get the most out of LinkedIn?
It depends on what your objective is. If you are a B2B consumer and you want to use it, I think the first thing is to recognize that what LinkedIn's probably trying to guard is a good user experience. So they want your business, but they also don't want to pollute the stream. And what happened in the recruiting business, I think, and this especially after I left the organization in 2013, is that the biggest users of the recruiting platform were the biggest polluters. That people were not being thoughtful. This is not a place to go spam people. This is a place to have greater insight, to have a better starting point in your interactions with somebody or some other entity. If you want to alienate yourself on that platform, just use it without any thought and just start sending mindless notes out to people. I receive them every week. People saying, hey, would you be interested in this data entry clerk job? I'm like, well, obviously you haven't looked at anything on my profile. I don't know how you found me.
I give a public service announcement to all of my clients. On the desktop version, when you go to connect with someone, it reminds you, hey, it would be nice to leave a message as to why you're connecting. The mobile doesn't do it. I'll often be at an event now. Back in London, we're actually able to go out to events now. I don't carry business cards anymore. I like to connect straight away. But even if I've met them face-to-face, I'll still say, you know, Steve, it was great to meet you tonight at the networking event. I'd love to connect with you. Because like you, I get hundreds of connection requests, and I want to remember who they were and why I should connect. It's a bit like me throwing my business card at you and walking off. Why would you do that?
There is a feature on the mobile device, I think, but it's not intuitive for you to be able to add a little context to it, because I agree with you. I really also welcome and accept more invitations when someone has put a little thought into it versus just a reach out. But I have been as guilty as the next person of just sending something, connection request, because I know I'm going to meet the person shortly and I don't include an introduction, just out of expediency sometimes.
The future of work, you talk a lot about the future of work, both in your book and your public speaking as well. I'm also asked what the future of work is. In your book, you say it's about being more human. Is that possible in an increasingly digital and detached world?
I think it has to be, Andrew. It really does. The big inspiration for me to write this book was fatigue of all the fear rhetoric I was seeing from companies, from the media, and from schools. You know, half the jobs tomorrow don't even exist today. And I think that rhetoric, whilst I understand where it's coming from because people believe that they need technology to be competitive. But if you want to build a compelling career, I think it's your human attributes that are going to distinguish you, because hard skills can be taught. Things like communication, building loyalty, trust, influence, leadership, teamwork, and agility and adaptability. Those are fundamentally human traits. And that's why I believe if you want to distinguish yourself in the future as a company or as a professional, those are the skills that you should be doubling down on. Of course, you need to be mindful of new technology, but I think we've lost a little bit of the plot here, Andrew, in that I think people, when they're facing a concern, immediately default to, well, it must be a technology purchase that we need to make for us to be more competitive, versus, well, maybe there's a communication breakdown, maybe there's a misunderstanding, maybe there's a strategic decision that needs to be made, versus investing in more technology.
So you deal with a lot of different companies and you must see a lot of good and bad practices. Who's getting the next phase of work right?
The ones who are getting it right are the ones who are willing to experiment right now. And we're still on the frontier because the ground isn't firm. So when the ground isn't firm, organizations that are used to making final decisions are very uncomfortable because they can't see the future. And this is part of the tension, I think, that we're facing right now is we're used to a decision-making and a leadership model that says we need to make decisions based on the goal of trying to have consistent, reliable outcomes. And right now we're in a domain where so many things are unknown, so we almost have to build for instability. And the organizations I'm seeing, Andrew, that are starting to figure it out are the ones, well, technology generally is earlier up the adoption curve because they're used to iterating, which is software development, A/B testing. They're easily migrating that over in how they think of people strategies. Organizations that are not heavily technology focused are not usually in the realm of having comfort level with evolving their culture and their business structures. And so they're struggling. Those are the ones who are calling me right now. They have got the deer in the headlights, if you will, just not sure how to handle this consistently evolving. It's like swimming in the ocean for the first time. You've only been swimming in a pool. There's undertows. You can't even see, and they're pulling you different ways. And you have to learn a different way of navigating that water.
I was listening to one of your podcasts in researching you for this podcast today, and I loved a quote with your interviewer. The only legal performance enhancing drug is trust. How important is trust going forward when, as you say, the ground is now very unfirm?
Well, it's always been phenomenally important, and it's going to be even more important. I mean, as you know, and you're a student of this, the two biggest dimensions that all the research shows that organizations need to focus on if they want high-performing teams is psychological safety and trust. And I think, and I really believe this, that our organizational historical practice of measuring engagement, employee engagement, trust has always been a part of it. But I think that trust should be the main thing that we take a look at right now, because when things are moving fast, when there's so many unknowns, the thing that you need in an organization to do is build trust. And how you do that, you know, transparent decision-making and lots of communication and lots of feedback collection is super important. So it's only going to get more important as we have too many things to defocus us and distract us and make us fearful today.
Trust goes both ways. So now that we're more distributed, we're working from home, I'd imagine a lot of HR directors, a lot of managers are saying, I'm not sure if my team are being productive. I'll give you an example. Two of my friends who shall remain nameless, they now adopt a thing called a mouse wiggler. It's a USB stick, and it basically simulates the mouse moving every 30 seconds or so. This means that their instant messenger terminal basically stays active and it's always green. And I know that these people have said, I just need to have a nap, but I've got to put my mouse wiggler in because my boss will then think I'm skiving off. Where actually I'm dealing with a mental health issue or giving myself a break. So how do we instill trust when we can't see the people that are working for us?
I think both parties, as you said, are part of this relationship, and both parties need to be more intentional today around communicating, exchanging feedback. If we've learned anything during the pandemic, it's that we've become more aware of the personal lives of our coworkers. And I think that's hopefully a good thing long-term, that we appreciate the circumstances and how they contribute to someone's productivity. And I'm hoping that closer relationship that we've built during the pandemic, we've all had this shared experience and it continues, that will lead to greater communication and greater trust. But listen, if someone's working in an organization, as the two folks that you allude to, that believes that if you are active is the only indicator of your productivity, I think that would make me pause and stand back and say, am I really in the right organization? If me having to wiggle my mouse is important for me to keep my job.
I know people are asking, you know, what is the future of business? Is it being in the office, working from home, hybrid? What's your view? But also importantly, how do we replace those stolen coffee moments when we run into someone at work? How do we do that when we're remote? That's the one thing people tell me that's missing and they want back.
If we have to first step back and say, we've just been presented with the greatest opportunity of our lifetimes to rebuild the way we used to do stuff, and just pause for a second and say, maybe the way we were, maybe the way a business happened, the way work happened, wasn't as optimal as it could be. And what ways can we leverage working more remotely now until we have more clarity? Such as, how can we eliminate bias? How can we grow diversity of input? Most organizations I've ever worked in always had somebody who wasn't in the room, maybe an executive in another region or another time zone, and they always felt disconnected. And now they're on equal footing with their teammates. To answer your question more specifically, when you say, hey, where are those informal moments happening? I totally agree with your concern there, because as a human resource person, I've found that the moments of greatest candor in any relationship in any organization are always the informal ones. What we have in this work from home, this black screen reality, is we have most of the encounters are planned. Those listeners who have children will know the best conversations you have with a teenager are not when you say, let's sit down and have a talk. It's when you're driving them somewhere or you're in the car and you're not planning to talk about something and something surfaces that wouldn't have come out in a more formal setting. And so that's one of the reasons why I suggest, while we're navigating this complex new frontier of work, is try to build in informal moments, try to build in downtime, try to build in fun and lighthearted exchanges with people, and some unpredictable as well. I know companies doing things like coffee roulette. They just spin a wheel and two names come up and those people have to have a virtual coffee or a virtual lunch or a virtual conversation. Organizations that are putting department versus department online gaming competitions together. We have to recognize this is a hard time for everybody. And so trying to build that in. This is the number one question I receive from all my clients. What should we do? Stay at home. And I say, I can't tell you the answer because I'm not in your culture, but I do know the pathway there is to ask your employees and to test things out and to try it, not as a whole company, but different departments, and get feedback. And where you're probably going to land is some complex patchwork of different circumstances for different jobs, different people in different departments. And let's measure our success on, is the company thriving? And I have two great examples to share with the listeners today of conversations I've literally had last week with clients. And it went something like this. I would ask, what's your biggest concern right now? And they would say, well, we can't hire and retain the best people. They're leaving faster. And I said, hey, how's your business done during COVID? They said, it's exploded. We've done phenomenal. We've grown market share. Sales are up. And I said, I want you to put those two statements together. You have a more fluid workforce, and yet you are thriving. Maybe we should be starting to look at, wow, maybe we're overvalued people staying here a long time, and we undervalued new people, new ideas, new energy, new ways of solving problems. And we are entering a much more fluid world of work. We are seeing resignations at all-time highs. We're seeing people changing career paths at all-time highs. We just saw last week in the United States was reported 2 million people retired prior to what the estimate was of their retirement date. So we've got people making very big life-changing decisions, and it's not likely to change for a while. So I think it behooves us as leaders and organizations to at least consider, this is the new reality we need to prepare to create value within and find ways of unlocking magic in a place where people may not be staying as long as they used to. We all agree people are probably not going to stay at companies longer in the future. So let's build to anticipate that versus try to fight that inevitability.
Couple of things to unpack there. I want to go back to the comment you made before about the new way of working, experimentation. I talk a lot about disruption, and my favorite phrase is disrupt yourself before you're disrupted. Now, as a futurist that was asked actually 6 weeks before the pandemic, what will the next 10 years look like? I remember being on stage at an event in London in front of a bunch of lawyers and their clients. I said that we'll probably have more remote working and people will be more flexible. And lo and behold, that all happened. I'm very fortunate that the group of friends I have here in London have a range of very interesting jobs, include the mouse wiggling people. And one of them works for a rather large consulting firm. And she said, we've actually had to plan these serendipitous moments. She said that she will now go into the office she'll tell everyone I'm going in on Wednesday and Thursday. And she'll kind of clear a diary, because what happens is you bump into people. And if you've got planned meetings with external people, then it just doesn't work. So you almost have to engineer that and allow it to flow. And apparently what works well, and I'm interested in your feedback in your part of the world, they organize to have these days in the office and then do something social afterwards at a pub or a restaurant, because people crave that social interaction. Are you seeing the same thing where you are?
Yeah, Andrew, it's really fascinating. It's starting to hit my radar that people are saying, we're going back to the office, but we don't want to meet when we're in the office. We're planning to not meet. which is counter to what we thought we were going to do. The other thing that some data has come out in the last few weeks, Gallup has been doing these engagement surveys, and they're seeing that people who have been working from home for an extended period now, who weren't doing it before, are more engaged with their company. Now, think about that for a second. I'm less physically present within the environment of my company. I'm less leveraging the perks and the benefits of whether it's, you know, the lunchroom or the free snacks or whatever, fancy, beautiful buildings. I'm less benefiting from that and more in my own home and domain. And I'm more engaged in my company. And I find that's really interesting. And I think that's worthy of more exploration because my intuition tells me that the taste of freedom and independence and autonomy is so powerful for a lot of people and allowing them to manage their lives, hopefully with not having a mouse wiggler, where they can choose to shop when the stores aren't busy. They can choose a hair appointment or picking up supplies when the store doesn't have a ton of people fighting in the aisles on the weekends. So this is, I think, people's sentiment is changing because of that. And that's forcing, I think, organizations to rethink how all this is playing out, which is super fascinating, but also very scary if you're not used to creating value in your organization in a very mixed set of circumstances for your workers.
Well, anecdotally, my friends that work in the city or the West End or in Canary Wharf here, which is sometimes an hour or 2 hours away, they were spending 1.5 to 3 hours a day traveling. They've got that back and they're actually working longer hours and they're happy that they're not having to, you know, dress to impress to go into the office for an 8 o'clock meeting. Let me run one of my hypotheses by you because you're the expert here and I'm just the part-time futurist. Howard Schultz years ago coined the expression the third place. He wanted Starbucks to become the third place. He wanted people to come in there and you've done it, I've done it as a freelancer, as a digital nomad and sit down and work there. I'm wondering if there is a third place. You said that people that are working from home feel like they're more engaged. I know, again, anecdotally, couples that are saying, you've taken over my dining room table, honey, for the last 18 months. I'd like it back. You don't want to go back all the way into the office, which is a 2 hour trek every day. But is there somewhere local? It may not be a WeWork or a Regus. It might be a specialized library that's had some extra desks put in or some sort of area where they've actually accommodated this in the suburbs. I know anecdotally, if you run a sandwich shop in the suburbs of central London, you're doing quite well because that's where people are now working and living. And the sandwich shops, unfortunately, in the center of London aren't not doing so well. So this notion of a third place that's in between home and in between work, maybe get people that live near me in my organization to meet there. Do you think that would work? Because it takes you away from busying up your space at home and annoying your spouse or your other half, but you don't have to go all the way into the office. Is that a happy medium maybe?
I think it is. And I think your instincts are right. We are seeing many people who are polling their staffs, talking about work from home, asking them, would you rather work in your home or does work from home some other place that you determine, does that appeal to you? And the answer is absolutely it does. And so I think what I'm starting to see is, and actually there's three companies that crossed my radar in the last 6 months, Andrew, that are building software to allow employees to visualize where their colleagues are working on particular days and at particular times. So I'm going to be in this neighborhood for these hours in this place and to be able to sort of geotag their colleagues if they want to, if they want to make themselves aware. But absolutely, whether it is some sort of hybrid share workspace, and these things are popping up, or it's a cafe. Coffee is usually at the root of whatever places people are choosing. And it's funny you should mention Starbucks because we worked a product with Starbucks. It was in beta and we couldn't agree. They're notoriously challenging to negotiate with as IBM used to be in the old days. But we said, hey, we're going to create this thing that basically says anyone else who's in the Starbucks, if they agree, they can share who their profile is. So people could, in theory, network. They were not willing to pay the price that we thought that product was worth. And they was like, well, it should be free. It is a feature now that you can turn on if you're at a conference and say, I am so-and-so and I'm here at the conference. And so other people can say, oh, wow, I'm there too. I didn't know that you were there. So their technologies, what I'm trying to say, is going to enable maybe some of those informal connections or network growth moments in places where people aren't familiar with who they're working around, which could be interesting. Right? Like you go over to Shoreditch and there's a bunch of share workspaces and I'm looking for a co-founder or I need an idea for a new product and there's a bunch of product people here sitting next to me. That's going to absolutely happen. And here's what the long-term play on that looks like. In California, where I have close visibility and close interest in the real estate market, home sales went crazy. And at first, during the pandemic, I thought, that's not making any sense. In a period of stress, you'd want to guard your money. I was facing the same thing. I'm sitting here in the middle of my living room right now in my home, and the kids are having to sort of sneak by to get to the kitchen. It's not optimal right now to do this. But what was happening was everyone was buying a home with another room to work. I even called my accountant and said, hey, listen, I'm a speaker. I know I've written off my tax deduction for my square foot of my office, but I'm going to need a bigger space because I need a studio now. And if I do that and write off more, can I afford a bigger house? What's the new tax code? And she told me right away, she says, you would not believe how many people are upgrading the size of their home because they need another room. And that's not even including for schooling or for other kids. It's just the workspace, another room. Isn't that fascinating?
The BBC did an animation about what life would be like. This is probably more than 12 months ago. And one of the last things was people will move out of cities. And I've been studying that closely, and you're anecdotally conferring with what I'm seeing. Even my friends up the road, they're away at the moment. I've got their keys and they're showing their home because they need to move. They need to move somewhere with space. We are on a different path. Do you think people go back to the way they're going to go back to what they were doing? Or is this going to be a quantum shift that people are going to move out of cities? They're going to get more space. Will we go back to 5 days a week, or is this lost forever? What's your view? It's a very controversial discussion, and I'm sure HR directors and CEOs around the world are pulling their hair out about what is going to happen. Will this be a fad, or is it going to stick?
I think we're going to land in the next few years with a much more diverse landscape than we're used to. I absolutely think people, some organizations, and we're already seeing it now, want to revert back to what they know, what they're comfortable with, what they're confident they can produce value within. I think when you have leadership teams who are very concerned around network security, privacy, there's a level of discomfort, or if there's a lot on the line that we're managing billions of dollars of money, I need to feel a higher level of comfort. I want everyone within the walls of our space. And then they're going to be early adopters and people willing to try new things. One fundamental truth that will not change, and that some people say the genie is out of the bottle, is the workforce, the professional workforce, has tasted freedom and independence, and they are woe to release that. And that's a beautiful thing. But at the same time, many leaders have raised their comfort level that I can deliver value and I can manage and I can see performance remotely. And so now I've got a bigger talent pool to be able to address in theory. And now my only challenge is with a more distributed talent pool, can I manage over time zones and cultures and maybe new, you know, national cultures or subcultures? Can I do that effectively at scale? And the new technologies and new systems and new protocols are being built to facilitate realizing that. You know, shame on us if we don't at least come out and build something better. I do think we're still going to see lots of messiness. I mean, it is going to be messy. I was on a panel a few weeks ago around the future of training and leadership training. And people said, well, we have AI now. We have all these new tools. And I said, yes, we're not all agreeing on what a future leader looks like. We're not all having the luxury of time to invest in developing people because we're trying to survive as companies because all of our workers are seeing work differently. Human behaviorists will tell you, when under threat, what we revert to is what we know, and what we know is the old way. And we're not confident yet that we can create value long-term sustainably in this new weird way. So it's going to take some time. And I've been around people trying to change in my whole life, just like you have. We are slow adopters. We are. We're very, very cautious as a species. And that's about our survival instincts, probably.
Some very public examples of that. I want you back in the office. If you're happy to go to a restaurant, you should come back to the office. And the reason for that, as you say, is he's got a lot of things to manage and he likes stability. But another example recently, Google have basically said, if you move away, we're going to pay you less. But we're being transparent about that. But you actually told me a story that had to do with bus stops.
This is really interesting. And there have been a lot of stories that have come out recently around how do we address this new remote workforce compensation challenge? And as you pointed out, Google had taken a position, which some people were very frustrated with because Google is a market setter in a way. And a lot of people benchmark their practices against, well, if Google's such a brilliant company, all their people practices must be amazing, which is such an untruth. But anyway, a lot of people follow them. And so the story that I was sharing with you was back in the boom times of the dot-com era, 99, 2000, and then later 2009, 10, 11, when I was at the talent helm at LinkedIn, Google started to be very prolific around bringing talent from San Francisco to Silicon Valley on buses. And where they set their bus stops up drove up the market prices of the real estate in proximity to walking distance from those bus stops, so much so that it created this big gap between real estate in areas that weren't close to the bus stops versus areas that were close to the bus stops, and led to protests, landlords throwing bricks at Google buses. And it was really impactful. And I don't know to what extent we have workers who are distributing like this that could change local economies. But if you have a lot of remote workers in a small town and they're getting paid a New York City, London, San Francisco wage, and they can afford to make the local economics look silly because they've got much more disposable income, at scale, that could be a problem in theory. We'll see what happens. I know several towns right now that are facing this challenge where they're beautiful communities. Wealthy people can easily afford to work there. Wealthy people, in some cases, realize they really like to work there. And now the local fire workers, waiters and waitresses, school teachers cannot afford to live in those places. And that's a big problem. And everyone says, yes, we want low-income housing, but just not next to where I live. And so it doesn't become a reality. We're going to have some downstream effects that we still aren't sure of yet. You know, this notion of our city is going to be empty or not, we don't know. A lot of this stuff's playing out right before our eyes.
One point you made when we spoke was that Google's actually doing the right thing. It's looking beyond being able to attract the best talent and pay them a lot of money. They're actually giving back. They want to normalize this. They realize that having these aberrations around bus stops is the wrong thing for a company to do. Apple have recently said they're going to try an experiment to have their retail workers work some of the week in the store, then do some of the back office tasks from home. You've got the FANGs, the Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. They have so much power. Is it their responsibility, in Google's case and Apple's case, to set the agenda and try these things? Because they can probably better than others afford to fail.
I can argue this both ways, honestly. I think that first and foremost, they need to do what they think is in the best interest of their company. And that is not only just a profit, but it's doing things right for your staff and their families. But if you're in the B2C universe, like Apple is dramatically, there's going to be backlash if the consumer doesn't feel like the employees were handled fairly or properly. And also, I think there's some backlash around, is that a best practice that seems reasonable and fair? The opportunity right now is, do we have a new landscape of remote compensation? Yes, we do. How are companies handling it? And they're lining up basically in two camps. One is, we're going to adjust to local market. The other is, if you move away, we're going to red circle you. You're probably not going to have a salary increase there, which is leading to another argument, which is, well, you're saving money because I'm not in your building. You're not serving me food. Your real estate costs are going way down. Why are you changing my pay? Because my value is my value and it should be universal, which is a whole nother argument that I could get on both sides of.
So who's right? And who is advising the talent leaders of the future about what they should do? I mean, this is just as we all were sent home almost overnight, and there was no rule book about how to manage and get work done in a distributed way. And we're learning how to do that. And even 12 months later, I haven't seen great examples of training people how to do that. But who is advising these HR directors?
My advice is, and this is something I feel very passionate around, especially when you're in an era where there's a lot of uncertainty and you're having to make decisions in domains you haven't made decisions in before. How you make the decision is sometimes more important than what the decision is. If you go to the mountaintops and you don't gather input and you just say, here's the way it is, without testing, without marketing, without trying to pulse your environment, I think that's a failed strategy. I think engaging and asking for views and taking input and then making the decision and saying, here's why we did it and why we think it's in your and the company's best interests. It's the how that's almost more important now than the what. It's times like this, difficult times, when we see what leaders are made of. And it's a great time to build loyalty. So we've seen some companies that laid staff off. And I'll use Bird as an example. Scooter company in Santa Monica, California. When the pandemic hit, they couldn't afford to keep a lot of their workers on payroll because no one's using scooters. It was actually forbidden. And so they had to let a bunch of people go. So they put together this anonymous Zoom call with a recorded message from a lawyer that was like someone said it was like a Black Mirror episode. It was just the worst case study of the worst way to communicate a staff reduction. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have Airbnb, where the CEO is crying. He repurposes the whole recruiting team to be an outplacement team. The whole company gets behind trying to find jobs for the people they're letting go. And they do this staff reduction so well, it makes the people they let go more loyal to Airbnb. And so those are two extremes that we're getting to see right now. Two decisions were the same one. Got to let people go. How they did it was phenomenal. When people started to travel more, the former employees came running back, not bitter. And I guarantee you at Bird, people were running the other way when the jobs started opening up. That's what your choices are right now. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, says you're not hustling unless you're in the office. That's what we're making. Now, what I appreciated about his approach was there is no wishy-washy in that statement. It is very clear. This is who we are. Where you're going to run into trouble with your leaders, and this is for the HR listeners here, is when you're not, oh yeah, we'll get back to you. We're thinking about it. You better be a little bit more explicit around that. Like, when's the decision? What are the factors you're coming in? Because if you're wishy-washy, people are going to think that you're not really capable.
So the Bird and the Airbnb example touched on something I want to cover. That's an alumni. COVID aside, you were talking in your book and you talk generally about the fact that people don't stay at companies as long as they do anymore. I think the average is sort of 2 or 3 years, depending on the age group. So if you assume that people are going to leave, how should you manage that? And in a time of COVID, when you have to let people go, how important is an alumni? Talk to me about where alumni's work and why everyone should have one.
It's a really important concept, and just follow the logic train here. We're in the more fluid world of work than we've ever seen. And by that, I mean more people are leaving companies faster than ever before, and nobody thinks that's going to change. Therefore, you are going to have more former employees than you've ever had. And what I try to point out in my book, and I give lots of examples of industries, businesses that are undertaking this, and LinkedIn is one of them, where they're implementing a different view of their talent pool, which is, I don't just care about my employees, I care about my former employees in addition to my employees. And I see my former employees as a network worthy of adding value to my universe, referring people for me to hire, referring deals to me, referring opportunities, becoming advisors if I want to get their opinion on some new product or some new market thing. Now, the IP lawyers are probably pulling their hair out when I say things like that. Oh no, you know, we can't extend the risk of losing our intellectual property out the door. I would say that is such an untapped opportunity for most organizations in the future, is use your alumni, curate it, nurture it, make it part of your community. And then it becomes something more meaningful than I only care about you when you work here. Moving to I care about you for your whole career sort of takes the pressure out of that situation. Let's not have a charade that you're going to wink, wink, commit to me to stay here a long time, and I'm going to wink, wink, commit to employ you for a long time. Let's both agree this may be a short relationship, but why don't we get into it together for the long term and help each other out for the remainder of our working lives? And that's something far more aspirational, I think, and it takes the pressure out of the situation, and it's a much more honest conversation. How many organizations do I see doing this? Not very many. And this is a big pivot because we're used to seeing a resignation almost like a divorce. What? You don't like me anymore? It's like, is it me? This is very emotional. And I think we have to be smarter and more mature about this. And I get 2 to 3 emails a month, invitations from LinkedIn to join something that the community is working on. And I feel like I still care about that organization as a result. And some organizations are pretty good at it. The consulting industry has a lot of, you know, here's all the job openings, or here's what's going on with the people that used to be at Ernst & Young or Deloitte or so forth.
I just want to finish on some learnings from the book. What was the most surprising thing that you saw? You started writing it in 2019 when we didn't know there'd be a pandemic, and you kind of finished it during that. What's the one thing that stood out for you?
Probably the one thing was my fear when the pandemic hit that a lot of the work that I was doing might not have any relevance. I was really worried. Very quickly realized that everything that I had been seeing and forecasting was only being accelerated in the pandemic, and everything was relevant, such as concepts like, I think in the future, we're going to hire more on what you don't know yet, but you can learn, than what you know. I know my business is going to change. I know the skills I need are going to change. And the more I know you can change, the more valuable you're going to become to me. If you're only a narrow expert and you're not easily capable of learning new things, you're not as valuable to me. And this is what I'm talking about, human skills. The most important skill right now is the ability to learn. And that became more and more clear to me, Andrew, as I wrote the book. I've always said, oh, be a lifelong learner, have a growth mindset, be curious. But truly, when I started to see my recruiting friends and hiring managers start to look at candidates in a new light, I guess what you know is important, but it's more important to me to see the trail of how fast you learn these things than what you actually did. And so that is really an interesting trend that I think is going to impact how people are viewing talent in the future. And that kind of surprised me. I mean, I sort of knew it, but not to the level that it's become really clear to me.
So I'm going to squeeze another one of my hypotheses in here. I talk a lot about digital first impression, and I actually give almost a masterclass on LinkedIn about what it says to you. Because at the moment, and McKinsey did a report saying that B2B buyers actually like being sold to remotely, and this is likely to continue. And if we agree with that, probably the first interaction you're going to have with someone new is going to be online. Your digital first impression is important, but your digital footprint shows what you've done. And if you look at my career, your career, we've done different things, we've pivoted, so probably we can learn again. How important is that digital first impression and your digital footprint?
I think it's increasingly important. Just look at how TikTok has exploded. And what is that? It started off as a 30-second video and people just can't put it down. And I think that's really important. We saw viral growth with network connection requests in the early days of LinkedIn when someone just had a photo. And that just that elevated their digital footprint a little bit more. There was a little bit more texture. and someone was much more likely to receive invitations when they had a photo than when they didn't. But it's still a new frontier, Andrew. I mean, we're still such at the early phases of what does this all mean? We have access to more information than we could possibly digest. I think what I'm hopeful for is the increasing number of ways that we can express ourselves more completely when we're applying for an organization and we know more about an organization's fit for us, cultural compatibility and so forth, that I'm hopeful we're going to have more intelligent combinations of people and employers, and also people being able to find independent ways of earning a living, which is definitely growing. The number of startups that have been filed for in during the pandemic is greater than it's ever been. So I'm hopeful that's going to lead to some good outcomes. But again, I think your hunch is right there, and you're seeing a lot of what I'm seeing.
The other thing I'm seeing is the rise of the gig worker. And I'm not just talking about the pizza delivery driver or the Uber driver. It's the executive gig worker. You and I have been independent consultants for years, and we have a new client almost every week. Do you think with people reevaluating their career, reevaluating the purpose, before the pandemic, I was noodling on an idea where you might be a CFO and you're a very experienced CFO. You've got to the top of your career, but you only want to work 3 days a week at this company, 2 days at another, and you might volunteer once a month somewhere else. And so there have to be situations where you can manage that. Do you think we're going to see the rise of the executive gig worker?
I think we will, but I don't think it's going to be as fast as we would like or as we need. In the United States, where I spend most of my time, we have a healthcare system. And we have in finance in general, the way that they forecast is headcount driven. It's not, you know, labor dollars driven, it's headcount driven. And so we've got all this inertia and all these frameworks that we've used that sort of inhibit that. And in California this past year, we passed a bill called Proposition 22, which created a new hybrid worker, which is essentially the gig companies trying to work around having to foot the full medical bill of someone being considered an employee. And so DoorDash, Uber, Lyft, and Instacart poured in over $220 million to get this thing passed. It did pass, but their platform was people want their independence. You know, we should be able to do this. It passed, and then a local district court just struck it down, saying it's unconstitutional a few weeks ago. So we're in a new frontier now. And I think a lot of the framework around retirement and all these other things, getting a mortgage, doesn't support the gig work. So I don't think we're going to see as much of an explosion. Sure, if you're later in your career and you're financially independent and you can do these things, fine. But the people who really need to make this work, a lot of the frameworks, taxation, loans, mortgages are not built to support gig at scale. And so that's going to block it. And in the US, like I said, healthcare is a huge block.
What's interesting in the UK, so Uber have had numerous run-ins with the authorities around licensing and everything else. In every part of the world, they've pushed back on calling people employees. And they've pivoted so massively. There are now full-page ads in the newspapers and on the tube stations and on bus shelters saying, if you work for Uber, you can have paid time off. If you work for Uber, you can actually get pregnancy cover and all those sort of things. So they're now using this as an acquisition tool, which is kind of naughty because they spent so long pushing back. Now they're going, hey, we're a cool employer and we're giving you all the benefits that you should have had because we've been told to. So I'm wondering whether it's just been smoke and mirrors and they've held off for as long as they can to not do this. And eventually, yes, you actually are an employee and you should have benefits. So I'm wondering whether they're going to say, hey, what happened in the UK? We want to bring that over here.
If you were using Uber as an example, there is a long history of transgressions in that organization that make me, as a student of business, not respect their history. I think they're on a good trajectory, and I'm happy they did a reset with the whole leadership team and even some board of directors that needed to be switched out. I like a little bit of their rebelliousness that, you know, some of these things are ridiculous rules, and yes, we're going to break them, and it challenges the rule, some cases in a good way, in some cases not a good way. I mean, the way the whole taxi system worked in the UK was, you know, high accreditation, lots of certifications needed. And for someone to just come in and have the government allow that didn't seem fair at all. But it is interesting how it's going to play out, facing a lot of the regulatory hurdles that vary country to country.
We didn't get on digital disruption, which is a pet project of mine, but I'll give you an example. In the taxi, I've lived in the UK for 15 years, so I've lived here pre-Uber. And you're right, the UK system is very regulated. There's a thing called the knowledge that takes 3 years for drivers to learn all the routes, whereas an Uber driver uses a GPS. But I got to tell you, no one carries cash anymore. And even 10 years ago, I didn't carry a lot of cash on me. I would try and hail three different cabs and they'd say, do you take credit card? No, sorry, Gov. And they'd drive off. What Uber did was it made every single taxi in London have to accept credit. In a pandemic, I just don't carry cash. That's a great disruption, but it happened slowly. As this is the Actionable Futurist podcast, can you give us some actionable tips for today, tomorrow, and next week that my listeners can actually act on now?
The best thing that I would suggest everyone action on right now is recognize that we are in a new realm when it comes to work, that what is guaranteed is that you are more valuable the more you invest in yourself. Take advantage of all the unbelievable amount of free learning. Take advantage of this opportunity to seek new ways of interacting with people, new ways of growing your network. Build in the informal moments, if you can, into your schedule and appreciate that those are sometimes the downtime. For me, is the times of best thought, creativity, not just the busy work filling in there. And keep your eyes open all the time. I think that there are no promises today, and it is very healthy for you to always have your eyes open for new opportunities. I have a whole chapter in the book on this one around just, we're all entrepreneurs. We really are in this economy. And I think reshaping how we look at it, we need to take advantage of this time to rebuild something better.
Now, you mentioned the book. It is an amazing book. It's a great read. It's only $1 or 77 pence. You are giving it away. If you don't go onto Amazon now and buy it, you're wasting your time. So how can people get the book and how can people find out more about you and your work?
Anywhere books are sold, you can find my book. We have it on Kindle, on special right now, which you mentioned, on Amazon, all places, bookstores, other book outlets, Goodreads, etc. If you want to go to stevecadigan.com, you can go direct to my website, and my publisher's got a link there. You can buy direct from Amplify if you want to. Workquake, I'm super excited about it, and thank you for your support. Again, stevecadigan.com if you want more information on me, but I really would love for you to pick up a copy. That would be great.
Workquake is the book. It's a great read. Go and buy it now. Steve, thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to speaking to you in a few months to see how things have progressed.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Thank you for listening to the Actionable Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at actionablefuturist.com. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops delivered in person or virtually at actionablefuturist.com. Until next time, this has been the Actionable Futurist Podcast.